It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll take a look at this week's primary election in Georgia, how it compares to Wisconsin's election in April, and what these primaries could signal about November's election amid the COVID-19 pandemic. First, it's time for Food Friday. A sure sign of early summer might be when the folks with gardens are encouraging everybody else to take some rhubarb off their hands, which you might be doing right now. Rhubarb has a unique flavor, kind of tart, until you add some sugar to it, but there's a lot of ways you could try to use it up. Deb Melian is an online writer, recipe developer, homemaker, and traveler. Her website is wisconsinhomemaker.com. There, she shares her favorite family-friendly recipes, along with helpful seasonal tips for your home and garden. Deb, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Deb, I think there's two schools of thought when people cook rhubarb. Some people love it. They're happy when it rolls around. And some people are thinking, I got to do something with it. Where do you stand on rhubarb, Deb?
Well, there are so many things you can do with rhubarb, and it is a really versatile ingredient for your cooking, and especially at this time in late spring and early summer, I think we all should really, you know, get on board and take advantage of this really great ingredient that can, you know, add a lot of freshness to a lot of different recipes.
And it's, you know, usually used in desserts. I understand it's technically a vegetable. Do you use it ever in savory dishes? I can't think of what it would be. Do you have anything in mind?
Well, you can. I mean, you can make it into even something as simple as like salsas. You can do it in chutneys. There's a lot of, depending upon what type of ingredients that you use, you can really affect it. Now, I mean, yeah, you're right. It was considered a vegetable. It is botanically considered a vegetable, but most people do use it for dessert because it somehow, when you do add the sugar to it, it really blossoms, and a lot of people also like to use berries and which we have also at this time of the year, to really, you know, push the flavor forward.
My greatest gardening success is my rhubarb plant that's right next to my compost bin. It was there when I moved in, so I can't take any credit for it. Do you have a rhubarb plant yourself?
I don't have any right now. I did have it at our old house, and it's really easy to grow. I mean, a lot of people will start with the plants either from seed or from starters, that they might have either bought from a store or, like, say, for example, from a family member, which is what I did. And there's a couple of things when you do plant it. You just got to give it plenty of room because it does grow large. And
yeah.
So it usually they say, you know, like 4 to 5 feet between each plant, you know, like from the middle of the plant to the middle of another plant. And then you got to give it a year to grow and get itself established before you can grab the first fruit. What I find interesting when I was kind of, you know, looking online about all of this information and doing my own personal, because I love rhubarb anyways, but was that it grows as far north as Alaska. Go figure.
Wow.
And as far south as Zone 7. And those folks down south, you know, they can really push it if they give, you know, the rhubarb some, you know, afternoon shade. But for the most part, like for us here in the Midwest, it really is one of the perfect climates for it to grow because it needs to have frost to really, you know, get established and to keep healthy. And so it can go down as low as 40 below. And then it can get as hot as whatever our temperature and our climb offers. Go ahead.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Deb Melian. Her website is wisconsinhomemaker.com. We are cooking with rhubarb. Deb, we'll get to some of your recipes in a minute. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bailey is with us in Beaver Dam. Bailey, hi.
Hi there. How's it going?
Good. What do you got for us, Bailey? We lost Bailey. Okay. Bailey said he had a good savory rhubarb tort. Well, I was hoping to hear more about that, but there's at least one person who cooks savory stuff. Now, I think a lot of people, Deb, will think of rhubarb maybe in a pie, and that is one of the recipes you shared with us this time around, your triple berry rhubarb pie. We've got this up, by the way, at WPR.org/Food Friday. Deb, tell us about the pie.
Well, actually, it's a crisp.
Oh, it's a crisp. That's right.
Yeah, but I do have a rhubarb pie on the website. But this is the rhubarb crisp, and the reason why I use that is because I was trying to balance it with other berries in that, and it's a really simple recipe that starts with a fruit filling, and then it has a crisp topping on top. And for the filling, you're going to use some sugar and cornstarch, and the cornstarch is just going to help thicken the sauce, because when rhubarb cooks and bakes, it breaks down and becomes liquidy. So the cornstarch kind of binds that. And then you'll add in frozen berries, and then, of course, your spices, which is like cinnamon, ground cloves, nutmeg. And then for the crisp topping, I like to use quick cooking oats along with some brown sugar, melted butter, flour, and then again some cinnamon. And you mix that up, and in a pre-greased baking dish, you just layer out the fruit filling, put the crisp on top, put it in the preheated oven at 375, and bake it for about 45 minutes or until bubbly. The one tip I like to tell folks is that, you know, make sure you put a baking sheet underneath just in case it bubbles over. But it really is a wonderful dessert to make and bake. And you can top it with whipped cream or homemade ice cream and or custard or whatever you want to put on there, because it is a very awesome recipe.
And I love making crisp. I make it a lot because I'm not too lazy to make a pie crust is part of the reason. And it's hard to screw up, except the last crisp I made with rhubarb and apples and blueberries, it was really tart. How much sugar do we need to balance out, or other fruit do we need to balance out the tartness of the rhubarb?
Well, you know, that's a really good point. You know, some folks like it a little bit on the tart side, some like it on the sweet side. For this recipe, I use about 2/3 of a cup of sugar, almost a full cup. And usually if you do, you could move it up to a full cup to 3/4 of a cup if you really wanted to have it a little bit sweeter. And also depending upon the apples that you use, because if you use tart apples, that's going to, you know, kind of take away from the sweetness as well. So kind of balancing that would help out a lot. So just if you want it a little bit sweeter, add a little bit more sugar to it. Can't go wrong.
Now, sometimes when I'm preparing rhubarb to bake, I'll peel off some of the stringy stuff on the outside, because sometimes I end up with an end result of some like tough, chewy stuff in there. Do I always need to do that? Or if I cook it enough, do I really not care about that?
Well, it depends upon what you're doing. I mean, if you're getting older stalks, you know, and if it seems, you know, when you get it, it's not as fresh looking. And usually, like when you go to the grocery store, or if you're cutting your fresh rhubarb, you know, if you're getting it between, say, now and before the end of June, usually, you know, you shouldn't have to do it just because it's fresh enough. But sometimes as you're getting closer toward the end of its growing period, that's when it might get a little bit more stringy. Now, some folks really like to do that and peel it. I don't particularly. I don't, because I've never really had to worry about it, because when I'm cooking it, it does cook off to some degree. If I make a compote, that's, you know, I mean, you're heating it pretty hot and it'll take care of that. So I would say, you know, just kind of, you know, check out the stalks the way they look. If you're worried about it, just take a peeler and just, you know, lightly take off the, you know, the top of it, and you should be fine.
We're talking with Deb Melian, online writer, recipe developer, homemaker, and traveler. Her website is wisconsinhomemaker.com. We are talking today about rhubarb on Food Friday. Want to hear from you? You can share your rhubarb recipe favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can call in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite rhubarb dish? What do you like to do with it? A favorite maybe family recipe or memory? Or do you have a question about what to do with all the rhubarb? Call 800-642-1234. Find some recipes from Deb at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Deb Melian, online writer, recipe developer, homemaker, and traveler. We're talking about the different ways to use rhubarb around the kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have some growing out back right now? Do you have a favorite recipe? What do you like to do with it? Or do you need some advice? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to our callers. Joy is with us in West Bend. Joy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share my mom's secret ingredient in rhubarb pie. She would always use oranges, or an orange. I can't even say what the amount would be, but to make the pie crust, she might have some grated orange peel in it, and then use orange.
All right, grated orange peel before Joy dropped off there. I think we're having some trouble with our phones today, but we got the gist. Orange and rhubarb together, I don't think I've ever heard of that, Deb.
Well, actually, you'd be amazed that it is. Rhubarb goes really well with citrus, like oranges and lemons and limes. And what it does is it actually brings out the freshness of the rhubarb and kind of enhances the taste of it. Hmm. And if you think of the, you know, like layers of flavor, it works and pairs very well together. So I would say, yeah, go ahead, give it a try. In fact, I wrote it down because I want to give that a try. I mean, I've usually used it like with lemons to again bring out the flavors, but that sounds delicious.
Joy, thank you so much for sharing that. Let's try Andrina now in Fox Lake, Illinois. Andrina, hi.
Hi, it's my first time calling. I've got it in the oven. I just finished it, and it's from the Taste of Home magazine, and it's called Strawberry Rhubarb Upside Down Cake, and it's got 5 cups of rhubarb, 2 packages of strawberry gelatin, 1/2 cup of sugar, 2 cups of miniature marshmallows, and 1 package of white or yellow cake mix. And you put the rhubarb in the pan, grease it, put it in the pan, put the gelatin, sprinkle it on, and the sugar, and 2 cups of miniature marshmallows, and then you pour the cake mix that you just made all over the top and bake it for 40 minutes and in a 350-degree oven, and I can hardly wait to taste it because it's so unusual.
Andrina, thank you so much. You skipped a step at the end though, Andrina. Hop in your car with that cake and drive it up here to us in Wisconsin. That sounds fantastic. Plenty of sweetness in there, Deb, it sounds like, to balance out the rhubarb a little bit.
Absolutely. You can't go wrong with marshmallows.
That sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that, Andrina. Well, I want to talk about another recipe you shared with us, Deb, for an easy rhubarb compote. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, this one is really one of my favorite. Because you can use it for ice cream, you know, topping ice cream or pound cake or just eating it as is. And it only takes about a total of 15 minutes or less from start to finish. What you're going to do is you'll start with about 4 cups of rhubarb. And I like to cut it into like 1-inch chunks so that as it's cooking down, it doesn't completely lose its shape, but it has a little bit of bite to it. And then I use about 1/2 cup of sugar, lemon juice, as I mentioned before, about adding a little bit of brightness to it, and then cinnamon, and then 1/2 cup of water. And then basically you just put it in a saucepan, and then you cook it down. Now, if you want it, again, a little bit more sweeter, you can add more sugar, or you can even, I've done this as well, where you add a little bit of maple syrup or maple sugar to, you know, add, again, a little bit of flavor to it. And then you cook it down, and then within about 10 minutes on about medium-high heat, it will be ready to go. And you can serve it like in a serve it over ice cream again, or any other type of topping that you want. It can also be used for another recipe that I have, which is Wisconsin or Midwest rhubarb margarita, which is an amazing summertime drink. And it's just the beginning base for that, and you go from there. But I've also used it to kind of like drizzle over like white fish or tilapia. And it really, you know, adds, makes a meal really special with that.
That sounds fantastic. Again, we have those recipes linked to WPR.org/Food Friday. Also a link there to Deb's website, WisconsinHomemaker.com. Deb Melian is helping us cook with rhubarb on this week's edition of Food Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Yes. Hi, Rob and Deb. This is Mike, rhubarb lover. And I, yeah. Well, last summer, I had this, had a piece of this rhubarb dessert, and I think it was like a shortbread crust and then a rhubarb custard top layer. Have you heard of that? Or if I was just going to invent something, could I, what would you suggest?
Well, Mike, I want to ask, you're talking like a rhubarb frozen custard or rhubarb like custard filling for something?
Like a custard filling. It was
gotcha.
A baked dessert. Got it. Thank you.
Have you heard of anything like that, Deb?
Actually, I have. I don't have the recipe offhand. I'd have to look it up. But basically, what it sounds like, what you would do, the custard itself would be probably, you know, like cooked over a, like a double boiler type of thing, so you don't overcook the eggs. And then you just basically, you know, what I would do is make the compote and then just kind of add it in with the custard. And then you could probably bake it, put it in the oven and bake it. And then add, you know, your spices like cinnamon and cloves and things like that. It sounds delicious.
It does. Thanks, Mike. Hope that helps you discover the recipe you're looking for. Let's go to another caller now. Robbie headed toward Armstrong. Robbie, hi.
Hi. Hi. Mike is totally talking about a rhubarb kuchen.
Kuchen. Rhubarb kuchen.
Gosh. And I have one old from my grandma who was born in 1881 was a rhubarb kuchen dessert recipe, which is phenomenal. And it's butter. It's total sugar on the bottom, butter, sugar, flour, and then you put the custard made with whipping cream, and then you put butter and sugar on the top, butter, sugar, and flour on the top, and bacon. It's phenomenal.
And that's like German for cake, right? K-U-C-H-E-N, kuchen?
Right, exactly. But I'm thinking of one, too, that's more nowadays. I found a recipe this year for a rhubarb margarita, which is, oh, wonderful.
That you have that rhubarb margarita, Deb. We have that linked at WPR.org/Food Friday. Tell us a little more about this one. We just touched on that briefly earlier.
Oh, the rhubarb margarita? Oh, it is really delicious. You can do it on the rocks, or you can make it as a blended drink. You start with the rhubarb compote that I just had talked about, and then that's your base. You put that in the blender along with about 1.5 ounces of tequila, 1.5 ounces of triple sec, some ginger ale, lime juice, and then you're about 4 cups of ice cubes, and then you blend it and go at it. It is so good. This recipe actually came about as a result of me, you know, with thinking about, well, we usually have, you know, strawberry margaritas. What would happen if I made it with rhubarb? And I actually had some compote made, and I gave it a try, and I've been making it ever since. It is so good.
Sounds fantastic, Robbie. Thanks for that, and thanks for the kuchen, too. Let's go to Nancy now in Maribel. Nancy, hello.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to suggest a rhubarb jam, which is so, so easy. Chop up 9 cups of rhubarb, put 5.5 cups of sugar on it, let it sit until it gets all watery, and then cook it until the sugar dissolves. and then add 2 packages of Jell-O, 1 strawberry, 1 raspberry, and cook until everything's soft, and then put it in containers and freeze it.
All right, frozen rhubarb jam, Deb.
Oh, that is absolutely, can you imagine with English muffins and that? Ooh. Unbelievable.
That
delicious.
Really good. Nancy, thanks for that suggestion. Talking about freezers reminds me, Deb, I see at the freezer section of grocery stores, they'll have frozen rhubarb. Is it pretty easy to freeze our own at home if we just can't use it all?
Absolutely. Yeah. Usually if you buy or you harvest your rhubarb, you've got about 10 days to keep it in the refrigerator, the veggie section, veggie drawer of your refrigerator. If you're not going to use it right away, my suggestion is just go ahead and chop it up. And I usually put it in, you know, cut up like about 1-inch, you know, chunks, put it in quart bags and just put it into the freezer. But before you do that, just make sure you rinse off the stems really good and then chop it up and put it in there. And you've got it year round if
All
it
right.
lasts that long.
Yeah. And how much longer are you looking forward to cooking with rhubarb this year? What do you consider the end of rhubarb season?
The end of rhubarb season usually is toward, they usually say like July 1st. And the reason is because you want to give, you know, the plant a chance to kind of rejuvenate after the harvest. And then also because it's getting warm, the plant gets stressed out. But even more importantly, the oxalic acid that's in the leaves, it gets concentrated more.
Uh-huh.
So, and that's the poison part. That's why you usually don't find that, you know, find any leaves attached to the rhubarb in the grocery store, is because it is very poisonous. And so it's like, if you do harvest it from your garden, it's just best just to cut off the leaves and leave them there and let them compost. And then just bring the stalks in and use
All
them
right.
as you want to.
I got to get out there and harvest. Deb, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
That's Deb Melian. Her website is wisconsinhomemaker.com. We've got some of her rhubarb recipes on our website at wpr.org/foodfriday. Coming up, we'll talk about Georgia's primary election and Wisconsin's as well and what they could mean for November. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, researchers are trying to get a handle on the rate of deaths for people who get COVID-19, but it's harder to answer that question than you might think. We'll talk about new reporting from WisContext that looks at the challenges of figuring that out and how researchers deal with gaps in the data. First, Georgia voters in many areas face long lines, faulty equipment, a shortage of poll workers, and more as they went to cast their ballots in the state's primary election this week. And the experiences of voters in Georgia echoed what some Wisconsin voters faced on the April 7th election, which was marked by confusion during the COVID-19 pandemic. Our next guest joins us to talk about what happened this week in Georgia and lessons that can be learned for the country as a whole as we head into general election season. Kathy Dolan is a distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what was your reaction to some of the news we saw in Georgia and all the election issues they had there this week?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, you know, Georgia particularly has had a pretty recent history of problematic elections, some of them intentionally created, some of them logistical, but they also, the problems that Georgia experienced also show us what is almost assuredly going to be a set of challenges nationwide as we approach the November general election.
Let's untangle it a little bit, because there's almost a perfect storm of badness in parts of Georgia. Taking it one piece at a time, let's talk about the pandemic and how it's affected elections. People reluctant maybe to go to the polls, floods of mail-in ballots, poll workers who might be in at-risk populations not wanting to volunteer, understandably. How much have we grappled with, how much have we reckoned with the impact of COVID-19 in the way we vote?
Well, you know, we haven't done it very well yet. We've done it because states have been working through trying to figure out how to have their primaries during the pandemic, but we haven't been successful yet. And so one thing that I would say to sort of organize our thinking about this is to remind listeners that in the United States, almost everything about the way elections are conducted are controlled by state and local governments. And so one of the challenges we face is that the general election in November is really 50 different state-level elections that are conducted by thousands of local elections officials. And so one of the problems we have is that there is no one way that we can prepare to do business in November. So the problems in Georgia were different across the state of Georgia. Some counties and local authorities didn't have problems, others did. So within a state, you can have a wide variety of experiences and capabilities and resources and problems. And then across the country, we're going to see a great range in those kinds of things. So we have had some experience in some states who have conducted or tried to conduct their primaries during the pandemic. Some states didn't have that experience. They got their primaries out of the way beforehand. And we've never done anything as massive as a general election under the circumstances that are at this point impossible to predict for November.
I saw one Secretary of State in the country saying, in effect, well, glad we weren't Wisconsin. We got to watch them go first on this, and maybe saying the same thing about Georgia now. Are there concrete lessons you hope that states and local officials are taking from what we've seen in Wisconsin and Georgia that they can apply and make maybe November go more smoothly?
Yes, absolutely. And I think we have to use every day that we have between now and November to prepare. So one of the great challenges that the states who conducted their primaries recently have faced was, as you articulated in the introduction, a very difficult time getting poll workers to staff polls adequately, a concern about people having to come out face-to-face to vote. And so what happened in a lot of states, as we saw here in Wisconsin and in Georgia and other states, one of the solutions was for elections officials to say, well, let's just do as much of this by mail as we can. Let's just do absentee ballots. Now, there are five states in the United States that conduct all of their elections by mail and have done so for many years, and generally without problem. The problem is that those states didn't implement those systems overnight. They implemented them carefully and in a constructed way over time. So part of the problem was that mail elections and absentee ballots sounds like a great solution to an in-person problem, but there are enormous costs in startup and in execution, and that's where a lot of states have had problems. So a state like Georgia, so part of Georgia's problems the other day were actually problems with new elections machinery that they had in physical polling places. Other problems they experienced were created by a wave of mail-in ballots. Here in Wisconsin, we had a crush of mail-in ballots. We had problems with ballots that weren't delivered to voters. We had problems with ballots that weren't delivered from voters to elections officials. So if mail balloting feels like a part of the solution for November, because we assume the pandemic will still be raging, then we need all of the time between now and then to get systems in place for printing and for distribution and for canvassing ballots and for counting. All of those things, you know, need to be figured out in the next several months.
We're talking to political scientist Kathy Dolan from UW-Milwaukee, looking at lessons learned from Georgia's and Wisconsin's primary elections, what it means for the big one in November. Kathy, let's talk a little bit about the politics of this here. First of all, with mail-in voting, President Trump in particular has been very outspoken, criticizing mail-in voting, raising concerns of fraud, and saying it gives Democrats an advantage. What do you make of the politics of whether states should expand mail-in voting?
Well, you know, it's unfortunate that politics has come to color people's thinking about this, because there is no evidence at all that relying on mail-in ballots helps one party or the other. So as with many things, the president tries to raise doubt and raise suspicion in people's minds without any corresponding evidence. And this is one of those things. Again, there is no evidence at all that conducting mail ballots helps Republicans or Democrats more. So that we are approaching the specter of the election with some people will have confidence in the election and some people won't because of that. So that's a problem in and of itself. One of the things about mail ballots, so in states that conduct elections by mail ballots, there are laws and there are...
Kathy, are you still there? I think we've lost our guest, Kathy Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, talking about voting, elections, problems that were encountered in Georgia and Wisconsin during the primary elections. We'll try to bring her back on to spend a couple more minutes on this topic. In the meantime, you can tell us what you want to see happen in our election system. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You know, you can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Kathy, do we have you back?
We do.
Okay, sorry about that. I think that's on our end. So I'm sorry, you were talking about mail-in voting.
Yeah, so you know, you raised the question of President Trump sort of raising a concern about mail ballots. Again, no evidence of mail ballot fraud, problems, et cetera. But one of the things about which people might be concerned in the fall is that mail ballots take longer to count because they have to be hand-fed into counting machines. And so if we have an enormous increase in the number of absentee or mail ballots that states and localities receive, we have to acknowledge up front that we are almost assuredly not going to know winners of elections on election night in the way that we're used to, because it will simply take much more time. Some states, I don't know if this part of what I said was on the air yet or not, but in some states, the law says you can't start counting mail-in ballots until after in-person polling places close, which almost assuredly means it would be some number of days after Election Day when a state or a locality would finish counting their mail-in ballots. So if President Trump is already trying to sow concerns about mail balloting potentially being fraudulent, imagine what he's going to be saying in November if we don't know the winner of the election until perhaps the Thursday or Friday after. So mail balloting taking longer to count is not in and of itself a problem unless political forces decide to try to make people suspicious and make them think it's a problem. So there are concerns about the politicization of this and, you know, how that's going to affect what people think of the legitimacy of a result.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Kathy, you know, we used to wait for, horseback riders to deliver the votes in elections in early American history. Do we need to just get more mellow with the fact that, hey, maybe elections don't have results on election night?
We do. And for that, we could perhaps turn to our friends in the media to help us be mellow, because, you know, part of the industry of TV and radio and the Internet has been, you know, to satisfy that curiosity and that demand for knowledge immediately. So if the networks can disengage and if, you know, radio can disengage and we can all take a breath, and if we know up front to be told that the expectation is going to be that it might not, you know, be the case where we can know the result that night, and people start to get used to that idea and understand it's not a problem or a negative, then that would go a long way to helping.
Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, no problem.
Kathy Dolan is a Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. She joined us today to talk about this week's primary election in Georgia, Wisconsin's April election, and what it all means for voting in November as the COVID-19 pandemic continues. Coming up, we'll look at what we know about the COVID-19 death rate in Wisconsin and why figuring that number out can be complicated. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, 94 African-American students were expelled from UW Oshkosh in 1968 after demanding changes from the school's leaders. We'll talk with a recent Oshkosh grad who says it's time for the school to do more to make things right. Now, a big part of understanding the COVID-19 outbreak is figuring out two numbers, how many people have been infected with the virus that causes the disease and how many people have died from it. Turns out those could actually be pretty complicated to figure out. Our colleagues at WisContext took a closer look this week at some of those challenges and how researchers are trying to solve them. Will Cushman is associate editor of WisContext. Will, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, what do we mean when we talk about the COVID-19 fatality rate or death rate?
That's a good question. And I think that the answer depends on what data you're looking at. But basically, as you said in the intro there, the death rate is the number of people who have died versus the number of people who have been infected with COVID. So based on the data that we have, our numbers are always going to be pretty incomplete. They're getting better right now, but we're never going to know exactly how many people are infected with the disease or exactly how many people have died. But our understanding of the death rate is getting better over time.
And I know from the very beginning, when this was just something happening off in China, I talked to epidemiologists who said, yes, the number looks like 3%. But a key fact here is that's only a number that involves the people who have been tested for and diagnosed with COVID-19. It doesn't include the people who have it, but didn't show symptoms, didn't get tested. So that fatality rate usually is a little lower than that initial number makes us think. Have we seen that here?
Exactly. Yeah, that's a really, really good point, especially because, as we know now, so many people who are infected with the virus that causes COVID are asymptomatic and are likely not getting tested. So there's a whole lot of infections out there that are getting missed. And what we're seeing in Wisconsin, based on data of confirmed and probable cases, so cases where a test has confirmed infection and then confirmed deaths, so where someone with a confirmed infection dies, the state has what is called a case fatality rate. So that's the fatality rate for confirmed cases of 3.1%. So pretty close to what you said epidemiologists were saying at the beginning of the pandemic based on kind of what was publicly known then. But we're pretty sure, epidemiologists are quite sure that the real death rate is quite a bit lower than even 3.1%.
That's the death rate. And then with the raw numbers of COVID-19 deaths, people who have died of COVID-19, in some ways that's trickier to count than I might have thought. Can you talk about some of the complicating factors there?
Totally. Yeah. So you're right. It's kind of surprising that we wouldn't necessarily have a really firm understanding of how many people have died from COVID. We track deaths as a society quite religiously. We know when, where, and how people died, or at least we think we do. And so in Wisconsin, we know that there are 689 people as of today who are confirmed to have died from COVID since March. But we don't know how many potential COVID deaths are out there that authorities have missed, basically because of a lack of testing. So it's the testing and then the subsequent death that leads to a confirmed death from COVID. So without knowing exactly how many infections are out there, we also do not know exactly how many people have died, especially people who may have died at home. So not in a hospital or nursing home or other healthcare setting. Some of those deaths at home are almost certainly getting lost, especially people who had other pre-existing health conditions that maybe were the death was confused for by being caused by that condition rather than COVID.
And complicating things further, you share the story of at least one person who wasn't counted in the fatalities due to COVID-19. They did have a positive test for COVID-19, but they also had lung cancer. The medical examiner, whoever made that decision, said in this case it was lung cancer. So people who make these decisions might have to weigh two different causes at the same time.
Yeah. I thought that was a really interesting story. That was out of Racine County. I talked to the medical examiner there. And he said that there was a case of an individual in Racine County who died under hospice care. And they had tested positive for COVID. They were tested because they had a known exposure to COVID. But they subsequently died, but their attending physician, their doctor, was quite adamant. The medical examiner said that no, their death was really caused by end stage lung cancer and not by COVID. So determining these deaths is sometimes a kind of tough judgment call. And the medical examiner in that situation, he said that he deferred to the doctor, because as he said, the doctor knows best in that situation.
We're talking to Will Cushman, associate editor of WIS Context, about efforts to track how many people are infected with the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, how many people die when they get the illness, and the overall fatality rate and what it means for how we try to deal with the disease. Can you talk about what the death rate has looked like for the state, especially in different parts of the state in particular, Will?
Sure. Yeah, so right now we have a case fatality rate of 3.1%. That's fallen from a high of over 5% in late April. And as you alluded to right there, the burden of the death toll is really varied around the state. About half of the confirmed deaths in the state have occurred in Milwaukee County, which has the largest outbreak in the state as well. And Racine County has the second highest death rate. In southeastern Wisconsin in general, so Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha counties have been experiencing more infections and more deaths. Deaths are also creeping up in Brown County, so around Green Bay, where there are some outbreaks related to meatpacking plants. And then there are also a few dozen deaths in Dane County, so in Madison, and then in Waukesha County. But even some smaller counties have pretty high death rates per capita. And often it seems that in these situations, a lot of those deaths are associated with outbreaks at long-term care facilities. And one thing that researchers are really quite positive about now is the disproportionate impact of COVID on older people. So really, the older you get, the more likely you are to suffer serious disease and to die. And so those outbreaks at long-term care facilities and nursing homes can really be quite deadly. And we've seen that in southwestern Wisconsin in particular, in Grant County and Richland County.
And Will, I know health experts aren't just collecting this data for data's sake. What are they hoping to do as they get to refine their numbers and the death rates and more better and better over time?
I think the hope is to be able to better inform public health decisions. So if you have a better idea of the overall death rate, you can make more informed decisions based on what you believe or know to be the relative risk of death. But I think researchers are also quite interested still in figuring out who exactly is most at risk. So we just mentioned that age is a big risk factor for death with COVID. But there's research being published pretty much every day looking into other risk factors for death. So we know that chronic conditions like diabetes and cardiovascular disease seem to be a risk factor for death. And we're seeing disproportionate death rates in communities of color and minorities, we think partly because of their higher incidences of some of those chronic conditions.
We'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
We've been talking to Will Cushman. He's associate editor for WIS Context. He joined us today to talk about the challenges of figuring out Wisconsin's COVID-19 death rate. He has a brand new piece about that with a lot more detail about how epidemiologists and others are trying to track this information and then make use of it. You can find that story online over at WIS context.org. While you're there, you can see a lot of reporting from over the last couple of months, actually, on COVID-19, how it spread in the state, and how policymakers have tried to keep a handle on it. Again, find that all over at wiscontext.org and follow breaking news at wpr.org/news. A few years back, I talked to an organizer of Gator Fest in Leon in Monroe County. The festival was named in honor of an unconfirmed report in a national news outlet of an alligator sighting in the area. There are no real alligators roaming the streets or waterways of Leon, as far as I know. But as scary as it might be to even think about alligators in small-town Wisconsin, it could be worse. How about alligators that run on two legs, kind of like an ostrich? That might have been a real thing over 110 million years ago. As reported by the BBC, researchers working in South Korea found fossilized tracks that they say show a species of gator that could run on two legs, kind of like a modern-day flightless large bird, or maybe like a dinosaur that ran on two legs. It's not a sure thing. They just have the tracks, not actual remains of this bipedal alligator. But even with that info up in the air, an alligator that can run quickly on two legs sounds like some pretty good material for a nightmare. And maybe for a festival. If anyone is listening right now in Leon, why not add this prehistoric, hypothetical gator to Gator Fest? By the way, Gator Fest in Leon is still scheduled for late August of this year. I remember one highlight was a stationary parade. The parade stands still, the spectators walk past it. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.